The continuation of the Holy Gospel according to St. Matthew. When the Pharisees heard that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. And one of them, a scholar of the law, tested him by asking, "Teacher, which commandment of the law is greatest?" Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the greatest and the first commandment. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. The whole law and prophets depend on these two commandments." While the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus questioned them, saying, "What is your opinion about the Messiah? Whose son is he?" They replied, "David's." He said to them, "How then does David, inspired by the Spirit, call him Lord, saying, 'The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I place your enemies under your feet'? If David calls him Lord, how can he be his son?" No one was able to answer him a word, nor from that day on did anyone dare ask him any more questions. Thus were the words of today's Holy Gospel. St. Paul, in today's passage from his letter to the Ephesians, written while he was chained to a wall in Rome, made an appeal to the Christians there and to Christians everywhere and at all times. "I then, a prisoner for the Lord, urge you to live in a manner worthy of the call you have received." Speaking about the vocation to follow Christ, the call to be holy, to live with faith according to the Holy Spirit, and to share the gift of faith as of the greatest importance to others, Jesus makes that call very plain in today's gospel, as if he's giving it to us each anew early this morning. A lawyer asked Jesus, "What's the greatest of all the commandments?" And Jesus, in reply, tells us the single most important thing we need to do in life. If we do everything else, win 10 Nobel Prizes, win the World Series, pitching 21 innings as a starter, but don't do this, we will have failed the test of life. But if we do this and don't get to all the rest, we still would have lived life very well. We've heard Jesus respond so many times that we can think the question was a softball, but it was really a 100-mile-an-hour slider. There were 613 commands in the Old Testament. To choose which of them was the greatest was something that the scholars of the law had found difficult for centuries. How do you choose one of the 613? To select which was the greatest, Jesus went to Moses. And what Moses taught the Jewish people after God had rescued them from Pharaoh. From that point forward, faithful Jews have recited it every day. Shema, O Israel, hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. Therefore you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. Then God, through Moses, gave them instructions to keep hammering this reality home every day. Keep these words that I'm commanding you today in your heart. Recite them to your children and talk about them when you're at home and when you're away, when you lie down and when you rise. Bind them as a sign on your hand. Fix them as an emblem on your forehead. Write them on the doorposts of your houses and on your gates. Even though Jesus' contemporaries recited this when they awoke and went to bed, even though they had phylacteries to hang it down on their hair so there would be an emblem on their forehead, even though they put it on a scroll and installed it next to their front door. Jesus' Jewish interrogators still hadn't realized its supremacy. In other words, why God had them do all of these things. It was precisely because God, with all we are and have, loving God with all we are and have is not just the most important thing we need to do in life, but the way we will grow most in His image and the way we will open ourselves up most to His love. The command makes clear that it's not enough to love God with only some or most or almost all of our mind, heart, soul, and strength. God gives us Himself. He gives us His grace precisely so that we can love Him with as much as 100% of all we are and have as possible. He gives us His own love to make it possible to love like Him, to sacrifice for God with agape like He sacrificed for us. Jesus reminded His listeners of this in His response to their question. But then Jesus added something else unsolicited. He knew that if He stopped merely by mentioning the love of God, many would think that they were doing just fine. Because so many of them, as well as so many of us today, think we love God by the simple fact that we acknowledge Him, we revere Him, we have warm feelings of affection and gratitude toward Him. Jesus wanted to give us a clear and concrete means by which we could evaluate whether we're truly loving God. Because to love God means to love what and whom God loves. And if we're really loving God with all we've got, we're going to love those He loves with all we've got. There's a second commandment, like the first, taken from the book of Leviticus, that Jesus says is a co-greatest. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. The clear indicator of how we love God is how we love our neighbor, loved by God, made His image. Jesus, during the Last Supper, would set Himself up as a model for love of neighbor. No longer would proper self-love be the standard for our love of others, but His love for us would be that standard. Love one another just as I have loved you. When He asked Simon Peter 3 times after the resurrection whether he loved him, and thrice Simon said, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus told him, "Feed my sheep, feed my lambs, tend my sheep." Peter's love for the Lord would be shown in the way that he loved all those whom the Lord entrusted to his care. St. Luke's version of Jesus' response to a similar question by a scribe was the greatest commandment in the law. Jesus gave him the same answer. But then the lawyer asked a follow-up question. "And who is my neighbor?" And Jesus replied with the parable of the Good Samaritan, stressing that everyone is in our neighborhood, that we're called to cross the street to care for others in their need, to sacrifice our mind, heart, soul, and strength, and our money, our time, and our convenience, to care for others like a loving mom cares for a sick child. And St. John, who was present when Jesus spoke the words of today's gospel, made the lesson clear for the members of the early church when he said, "If anyone says, 'I love God,' but doesn't love his brother, he's a liar. For whoever does not love a brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he hasn't seen. This is the commandment we have from him. Whoever loves God must also love his brother." The thing many miss about Jesus' response to the lawyer's question today is what Jesus says after this literally earth-shattering twofold directive of love. By this added thing, Jesus makes love for God and others very practical and gives us the prism by which to understand everything He reveals to us and how He calls us in practice to love in a manner worthy of the calling we receive. I have found this one sentence to be one of the most helpful and practical sentences in the entire gospel when I teach moral theology to seminarians and deacon candidates, to young and old faithful alike. On these two commandments, Jesus tells us today, depend, hang, are pinned all the law and the prophets. In other words, all 613 commands that God revealed in the Old Testament can be summed up in either love of God or love of neighbor or both. This is so different from the way many of us and so many of our contemporaries look at the commandments. Let's just take a quick glance at the Decalogue. How could we ever claim to love God if we're worshiping idols or misusing His name? How can we claim to love Him if we don't worship Him on the day He calls His own? How can we love our parents if we dishonor them? How can we love others if we hate or kill them? How can we love our spouses if we're unfaithful? How can we truly love another if we use them for sexual pleasure and risk their eternal salvation? How can we love someone if we're stealing from them or lying to or about them? How can we really love someone if we're envious rather than happy about the good things and relationships they have in their lives? The commandments don't stifle love. They guide it. They form it. They mature it. The law of God is a law that trains us how to love God and others. And every violation of His commandments is a violation of God, the love of God and of neighbor. Therefore, whenever God tells us, "Thou shalt not," prohibition is to help us preserve love. It's like a signpost on a cliff keeping us on the pathway of true love. And God, out of love for us, gave us each command. That's why Jesus told us during the Last Supper, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments." And later, "I'm giving you these commands so that you may love one another." During these upcoming days, it's going to be very important for us as Catholics to live this twofold command of love God and neighbor. We're all going to be in a fishbowl made out of magnifying glass, thanks to the very welcome nomination yesterday of Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. Her love for God, shown that she takes her faith so seriously that she joined this covenant community, People of Praise, which is not a cult. It's a charismatic community that's very faithful and sacrificial and focused on the family. And if anybody knows anything about Amy Barrett, she is the least person who would ever go into a cult. Give me a break. But she loves God. She loves others. You'd have to have a heart of stone not to be very moved by the love of her husband and her for her beautiful family, especially going to adopt the children in Haiti, to give them a real chance at life. And how she looks at her legal vocation as a means truly to serve others. But her Catholicism is going to be attacked. And it's going to be very easy for us just to attack back, because that's the culture we live in. But that wouldn't be living our vocation in a worthy way. The way we have to respond is the way Jesus teaches us. And He meant it, even for 2020, even a month before an important election, when He said, "Love those who make themselves your enemies. Pray for your persecutors. Do good to those who do evil to you." We'll see that type of meekness and magnanimity in Amy, but everybody should see it in every Catholic. Now is the time for us to shine. Today we have another great illustration of what it means to live in a manner worthy of our calling. In a saint the Church celebrates every September 27th, because it was on this day 360 years ago that Jesus called St. Vincent de Paul home to heaven, saying, "I'm convinced to him, if he has ever said it to anybody, 'Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you fed me over and over and over again. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was naked, and you gave me your own clothes. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. Ill, and you cared for me. In prison, and you visited me, and you sent thousands of priests to visit me, and you raised so much money to ransom me. St. Vincent was a great teacher of charity who practiced what he taught in an extraordinary illustration of the single most important thing a human being has to do. Charity, Vincent told us, is the life of the soul. If it's not filled with love, it's basically a walking cadaver. Charity toward one's neighbor, he added, is an infallible sign of a true child of God. Continued, charity is the cement that binds communities to God and persons to each other. We should pray continually that God grant us the spirit of compassion that's truly the spirit of God. He would call the people of his own day to conversion by asking, what are we doing if we're not doing God's will? And God's will is for us to love one another as he has loved us. And he strove to make charity truly effective. The poor suffer less from a lack of generosity, he stated, than from a lack of organization. And he, out of charity, organized many charitable works so that the people loved infinitely by God wouldn't fall through the cracks. But I bring him up today because he's an example of conversion for us. 4 centuries after he lived, many of us can think that St. Vincent de Paul must have always been a model of Christian charity, a living instantiation of the Good Samaritan. But he wasn't. Far from it. He was self-centered, vain, ambitious, focused more on accumulating things and living the good life than giving things and himself away. His conversion to charity is something we can and all should learn from. For even though he knew God's teachings about love, and even though he could preach about them, at the beginning, those words of the Lord were just words. Born in 1580, Vincent was the son of poor farmers in southwestern France, the 3rd of 6 kids. His parents struggled simply to make ends meet. When Vincent's father recognized that his son might have a priestly vocation and that he was precociously intelligent, he and his family sacrificed most of the animals that provided their food in order to provide him an education through the Franciscan Recollects and later the Université de Toulouse. Vincent, however, was a selfish, unappreciative kid. One day when his father made a long journey on foot just to visit his son and came in his tattered peasant clothing, Vincent refused to go out even to greet his father because he was embarrassed by his dad's poverty. Vincent's ambition at the time was to become a priest, not because fundamentally he thought he had a vocation, but because he thought vainly that it might bring him fame and notoriety. He knew that if he played his cards right, he might receive benefices for rich churches and abbeys that would provide him enough income to permanently get his family out of poverty that embarrassed him so. Because of his genius and motivation, he raced through his studies and was ordained a priest at the shockingly young age of 19, even though canon law required one to be 25. He wasted no time trying to climb the ecclesiastical ladder. He became a chaplain to Queen Margaret of Valois and moved to Paris. As a brilliant baby priest, he quickly earned the reputation of a talented preacher, which gave him further entree into French high society. But the Lord had given him a real vocation, and the Lord didn't give up. He provided 2 very difficult experiences that helped Vincent to convert from his vanity and his rejection of Christ to serve the Lord. First happened in 1605, 6 years into his priesthood. After having gone to Marseille to acquire an inheritance from a rich widow, a sign of where he was placing his treasure, he boarded a ship to Narbonne that was captured by African pirates who brought him to Tunis, where he was a slave for 2 years. We have today a terrible plague of modern slavery, human trafficking for both sex and forced labor. And Vincent experienced that for 2 years. 41 million people live it today. God eventually arranged for Vincent's escape when he was able to persuade the wife of an ex-priest who had converted to Islam to preserve his life and to convert her husband, to give up their illicit arrangement and head back to France. And her conversion was the occasion of his own. And after his release, Vincent never forgot the misery those slaves were experiencing. He resolved to help them somehow, some way. There were about 25,000 poor slaves on the Barbary Coast, mostly Christian. He would send many priests and brothers to attend to their spiritual needs and never ceased to raise money to buy their freedom. By the time of his death, he had purchased the freedom of over 1,200. Most of us have seen the movie Schindler's List, with his bawling his eyes out at the end of the movie. If only he could have bought a few more Jews from death in the concentration camps. Oskar Schindler, the scholars tell us, saved about 1,100 Jews. Vincent de Paul saved 1,200 from perpetual slavery to the pirates. An incredible hero. The second experience that God gave him to help convert him was a crucifixion of his ego. After Vincent had returned to Paris, his roommate was robbed of 400 crowns, an enormous sum at that time. Convinced Vincent had to be the thief, he maliciously accused him to the police and to everybody else. Whereas earlier, Vincent may have trusted in his own abilities to defend his reputation with his tongue. Now he trusted only in divine providence who had freed him from slavery. Dieu sait la vérité, he would say. God knows the truth. As he bore the calumny for 6 months until the true thief confessed. The whole episode cured him of placing his treasure in human respect. From that point forward, he was truly free to seek God's interest in everything. And even though he would continue to walk in and out of French high society, his heart was set firmly on what the Lord willed, on God's glory, rather than the vanity of worldly success. He began from that period to welcome Christ in his poverty fully into his life and to help others make that same exodus from rejection to welcoming. He was recruited by the powerful Count de Joigny, Philippe de Gondi, to become chaplain to his family and tutor to his children. That was the assignment of the younger Vincent's dreams. But now it was an assignment he twice laid down in order to become a pastor in poor rural areas in great need of the gospel. Both times, however, Count de Gondi, who with his family loved Vincent, prevailed on him to return. And the second time they enticed him by promising that one of his tasks would be to teach the gospel to the peasants throughout their enormous territory who were in ignorance and moral disarray. The Count, who was prefect also of the French penal system, also arranged for Vincent to be named almoner and chaplain of the convicts in the galleys, which allowed Vincent to bring not just spiritual but material comfort to Christ in prison and in a distressing disguise all across France. The more work he did among the poor and the outcasts, the more he became aware of how much work still needed to be done. And he knew, as I quoted him earlier, that effective organization was essential. The history of the church is one of effective organization. If you read Pope Benedict's beautiful encyclical in 2006 called Deus Caritas Est, God is Love, he will say that the foundation of the diaconate was because charity was too important to fall through the cracks. And if the apostles were too busy with prayer and the preaching of the word, they needed help to make sure that charity was done. And that's why they founded the diaconate, because as Pope Benedict says, love of neighbor is just as important as love of God in prayer and love of God in the preaching of the gospel. And charity a la carte is not enough. That's why the church founded diaconia in the early church, what we would call Catholic charities, outposts that would do literally everything from feeding the hungry to the sick, etc. All the corporal and spiritual works of mercy were done in these diaconia, which was the church's organized charity. And Pope Benedict said there, the seculars, those who hated the church, particularly hated the church's charity, and wanted to drive the church out of business, saying that if the state did everything the church did, then the church would no longer have converts, because they recognized it was the church's charity that so won over the world. And atheistic states or secular states continue to play by the same playbook every age. Needed to organize to care for the poor. Just couldn't happen by random acts of kindness. Vincent began to recruit priests to help him in the work of preaching the gospel to the poor. And these clerics, drawn by Vincent's example, became the first members of the Congregation of the Mission. With the help of Saint Louise de Marillac, he established the Daughters of Charity to work in the many hospitals he was founding, to care for the sick, the incurable, the orphaned, the aged, the abandoned, to help in the relief of the indigent. He instituted the Ladies of Charity, a group of wealthy lay women who would use their social connections to raise funds needed not merely for the immediate care of the poor, but for their long-term education and training. In Paris, these ladies helped to run a soup kitchen that fed a staggering 16,000 hungry people a day. Vincent would say, "It's certain that when charity abides in a soul, it takes entire possession of all the soul's powers. Charity allows it no rest. It is an ever-growing fire." When we're filled with the love of God, it is an ever-growing fire that keeps us up at night as we think about people who are suffering. And that's the fire the people of his day saw in Vincent. That's the fire that the church ponders every September 27th. That's the fire that God wants to see in us. That's the way we love God and others with all our mind, heart, soul, and strength. That's the way we live in a manner worthy of our calling. And to help us, the Lord, here in the Holy Eucharist, whom the great saints of the history of the church and popes have called the Sacramentum Caritatis, the sacrament of charity, comes to strengthen us from the inside to love like this. The deacon St. Ephrem once said, "Whoever receives Jesus in Holy Communion receives spirit and fire." And this is the fire Jesus wants to ignite in you and me today. Praise be Jesus Christ.